Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello, hello. Welcome to another episode of the Punt Intended Podcast, a fantasy basketball podcast focused on Dynasty and a sports ethos production. I am your host, as always, Mark C., the Dynasty leader over at Sports Ethos. You can find me at MacAttack145 on Twitter and my writings and rankings over at SportsEthos.com. We'll get right into our first theme of the day, and that's a recent trend or topic that we've been seeing. And we did discuss this topic about a month ago, but it feels even more relevant now than ever, and that's silly season and specifically hot streaks. It can take quite a while for any stats to stabilize. That goes for shooting, three-point percentage, free throw percentage, field goal percentage from different zones, defensive rates, that being namely steal and block rates, and rebounding rates even. Those can take a while to stabilize. So you might be asking yourself, okay, you're telling us we can't treat these small season stats. How do we deal with these small sample sizes? Do we just ignore them, or how do we factor that in? And that's a tough question, and I'm going to try my best to answer it, but I think that's really what makes Dynasty so difficult, is because at the end of the day, everyone's trying to answer that question of what samples do we trust, what stats do we trust, and how do we evaluate players? And so I might take a little bit of a cop-out answer here and go with the old reliable, it depends on how we treat small sample sizes. Some of it is just faith in a player or young prospect that you have. If you are a fan of Jalen Green, you're looking at this recent hot streak and you're going all in and you're just saying, he's now figured it out. He realized it. This is his year three season and he just needed some goon to get out of the way and you can be all in on him. If someone who you're maybe not a fan of, I'm blanking right now on any names, but your faith in a player might dictate your level of faith in them. Or it might be a player with prospect pedigree. So Jalen Green again. Hey, he was picked top two for a reason. We have to trust this. We have to believe in it. This is finally the talent that NBA scouts saw. Sometimes a player that's picked early just doesn't pan out. We can think of Josh Jackson with the Suns a couple years ago, who was supposed to be this toolsy prospect. I mean, sometimes he flashed, but a lot of the times he just wasn't consistent or good enough to be worthy of playing time, and he soon flopped out of the league. Kevin Knox, drafted by the Knicks, I think 2018, around there. He had a great summer league, really hitting all these tough mid-rangers, and some people who love that prospect really bought into him as this next level, as really the next three-level great scorer. And yeah, we don't really hear him talked about much now because that was a small sample and it didn't last in his career. Someone like Delano Banton, who is really pouring it on now, people may not trust him just because he was a later round or a later pick in the draft. And I'm not saying whether you should or trust Banton's recent streak or not, but that would be sort of the things we're talking about with these prospect pedigrees. And how I approach a lot of these small sample sizes, it's a healthy dose of skepticism. As we previously discussed, it is a small sample. We have to be cognizant of that. There are plenty of studies out there showing that it takes about 800 threes before a three-point percentage starts to stabilize. And to be clear, that is 800 three-point attempts. Now, obviously, there's also a variety of factors that can go into that. If it's just the beginning of a player's career, skill improvements are a thing to a point. Team context, what's going on in the team? How is that affecting the player? Are they in a good environment to succeed? You can see this with the discussion around Cade Cunningham right now, or Paolo Banchero. Jalen Green, same thing, really, with his first two seasons on the Rockets being in a really non-conducive environment with Steven Silas. Injury. Sometimes just a player gets injured, can't get up to speed as easily, and then they suddenly are healthy, and then they can finally show what they have to bring to the table. that can definitely be something that affects a player's streaks. Or, you know, if you look at a certain range of dates, finally a player gets healthy and is actually shooting the ball well. That's just something very simple that can happen. We'll talk about Tyrese Haliburton later, but I think he's a prime example of how injury can affect these hot streaks or sample sizes. As we touched on earlier, skill improvement. Just players do get better. It happens. We saw that in a player we discussed last week in Jalen Suggs, who looks to have taken a leap forward in his three-point shooting. Now, I may not project this high water mark in seasons going forward, but it's more believable as a third-year guard that he just showed legit skill improvement. Skill improvement, though, is something we'll normally see in younger players. If it's an older player whose three-point hit rate suddenly spiked up, all right, may not trust it as much. We have a much larger body of work to rely on in that regard. So let's discuss some of the players I've mentioned and just hone in on how we look at that and address those hot streaks. So Jalen Green, mentioned him quite a bit here. And I talked about the Rockets in general last pod and Jalen Green quite a bit. So I won't go too in-depth on the totality of Jalen Green's game right now. But clearly he's been on a massive heater. And it's, I think, really important to look at the context, because I think there's a lot of context around this. First, the quality of opponents. It's been a range of tanking teams and also a range of good teams, though. So it's not just the case in previous seasons where the Rockets were a bad team, and I'm sure teams were just showing up expecting an easy matchup, probably not trying their hardest, knowing that the team was so bad that they could win, and Jalen Green can kind of just do his thing and ball out in March, and somewhat who cares. But the Rockets are a good team. They are a good team fighting for a playoff spot right now, and teams know that, and so teams should be giving them their A game and showing up to play. So that makes it a little more believable in terms of that team context and environment. So this could be a sign of figuring things out for him. It could just be shots going in. It's hard to tell. Obviously, the percentages are higher. He's making more shots. But what I can definitely say is he's looking more poised and comfortable running that high pick and roll and taking that pull-up jumper, which is something that has kind of somewhat always been present, but sometimes he would get flustered at the top of the key, top of the arc when handling the ball. So I think in that regard, it does make me buy into this breakout being more real than, so say, previous seasons where he's broken out, and some of us may have gotten teased by that potential. Let's touch on Delano Banton a bit here, who was moved from the Celtics to the Blazers at the trade deadline, and he's seeing a lot of minutes and doing really well in them. Suddenly, his volume is up massively per game this season, and he's hitting the shots. But he's only taken 116 threes on the season, which maybe that sounds like a lot, but as I mentioned earlier, it takes about 800 threes for that three-point percentage to start stabilizing and for us to trust those percentages. So that's not really a sample that I am going to buy into. I want to be clear that it's obviously better to hit the shots than miss them. I'd much rather rate a player who is hitting shots well than one that's not. That just seems like common sense. But the sample size isn't necessarily too large at the same time. And we just discussed with the Rockets how they're playing, I don't want to say real games or fake games. All these games are real, but more real games, I guess, more competitive games. And the Blazers are just not playing for that much, and opposing teams know that going into the building. So, yes, it's good for Banton and could be an indication that teams might want to see more of him and be more of a believer he can fit in a rotation. So that, in that sense, that's why it's better he's hitting those shots. It might lead to more future opportunities. At the same time, it's not necessarily something I'm going to heavily project going forward. And lastly, let's touch on Tyrese Haliburton. And this is going to display, I think, how injury can affect these sample sizes. Tyrese Haliburton was on fire in the beginning of the year with his pull-up jumper from deep. So his hamstring injury was on around January 8th. Pre that injury, he was attempting 6.7 pull-up threes per game at a 39% clip, which is really good considering that's pull-up attempts. That's not just three-point attempts. That's a very high volume and a very high percentage. at that time, it was pretty much towards the top of the league. It would be up there in terms of, okay, this is really good historically. Post-hamstring injury, he's taking only about five pull-up threes per game at a 29% clip. That is an ugly number. That is very ugly. It's less volume, and that percentage is just not something that you want a player doing, even one who has such a creation load as Tyrese Haliburton. So do I fully believe the beginning of the season sample? I mean, that isn't, it's a good volume, but it's, again, just like with Banton, Halliburton's pull-up sample volume wasn't great. We could go back in previous seasons and factor that in as well to kind of get this average weighted metric, say. But obviously, he probably wasn't as talented, or rather, his true talent probably wasn't what we saw at the beginning of the year. But it's closer to the pin for me, especially given the context of his injury. And just watching him, it's clear that it's affected him. His ability just to generate power, shift, lateral mobility, all those things that can come in when you're dealing with a hamstring injury. And he's clearly been playing through it. So, example of where injury can affect those sample sizes, and maybe we have to factor in context. And why I went back at the beginning of this question and I said, it depends. I think it really does depend. And at the end of the day, it's going to be up to you to what factors you trust in terms of those injury, the team context, skill improvement, what have you, or your belief in a player. I will have my own opinions, and that's usually what I'll base that on. And most of that criteria is what I'm using. But you might see something different, and you could be end up being right. Sometimes it is just a projection, and we do our best to project as best we can.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Now, we'll move on to some players on the upswing. And first, we'll talk about Tyrese Maxey of the Sixers. Maxey's someone who I think a lot of people projected to really step up this year in his fourth season on the Philadelphia 76ers, especially when there were rumors, not even rumors, really, when Harden put in his trade request, then the runway was pretty clear for Maxey to have a full breakout season, and he's done that. I definitely anticipated some sort of breakout, but I didn't think it would be to this extent. And it's twofold on why it's so impressive to me. One, it's the greater usage at, it's not the same efficiency as previous years, but it's close enough where it's still solid. So improved usage at good efficiency or similar efficiency to previous is really one of the hardest things to do. Usually, if you are upping your usage, that means you're taking on a harder shot diet, and that's normally affects you pretty negatively in terms of your percentages. And that's not to say Maxey's percentages haven't decreased, because they have, but they're still pretty well in line, pretty close to what they were in previous seasons. And just with more usage has come more counting stats, namely points, assists, and threes, which is great to see. If you're a fantasy manager of Maxey and you've been rostering him, hoping for this eventual breakout, it's arrived. It is here. What's even more impressive to me, and this is the second thing about Maxey's breakout, is his turnover rate. And why am I talking about turnover rate? Yes, turnovers are sometimes, I'll call it the hidden ninth category, but turnover rates on the court is really important. Not turning the ball over means you're getting up a shot. And maybe that's not the most efficient look, but it's better than turning the ball over. And something else that turnovers lead to is usually transition attempts for your opponent, and transition is one of the worst things that you can give up. So by limiting your transitions on offense, by limiting your turnovers on the offensive end, you actually improve your defense by a pretty fair margin. So that's something that can get overlooked in terms of how valuable a player is on the court. So getting back to Tyrese Maxey, his turnover rate has actually decreased this season from previous seasons. And reminder, his usage increased. So the fact that his turnover rate has decreased is actually pretty crazy, and it is actually one of the best in the league given his usage. So what that means is that he is the best, one of the best players in the league at limiting turnovers for high usage players. That is really impressive. And yes, he does have Joel Embiid there. He is a secondary option, but he's really more of a secondary primary option considering how often the ball is in his hands. And we also have to factor in that Joel Embiid hasn't been in the lineup in the past 2 months, really. And you might say, okay, well, Tyrese Maxey, maybe he tailed off without Joel Embiid. And I thought that would actually be the case, too. However, pre-Joel injury, that's about a 42-game sample size, he was putting up 26 points, 3.5 boards, 6.5 assists per game on 45% from the field and 37% from deep. And I want you to remember those percentages again. 45% from the field, 37% from deep. In 22 games with Joel Embiid out, this is starting on February 1st, 22-game sample, 26 points, 4 boards, 5 assists per game on 45% from the field and 39% from deep. Those are actually very comparable stats. Really, the only difference is that his assists are down about 1.5 per game, and that's it. So when we're talking about sample sizes, getting back to that recent topic we talked about at the top of the pod, this is where we see a full body of work with some different team context, right? We see without what I think most would say was the MVP frontrunner at the time in Joel Embiid, and without that MVP frontrunner, and Maxey has really just been just as good. So yeah, maybe he's a decent to very good primary only option. And that's fantastic. But he's also shown the ability to be an excellent excellent second primary option, which is fantastic. That means he can play in a variety of team contexts, variety of team environments, and just contribute very positively. And he's still young enough to develop some more on-ball craft. I wouldn't say he's necessarily passing guys open. He's more of a assist by volume and usage player than really generating high volume. Not high volume passes, generating high points per possession passes, I guess, if that concept makes sense. But he's only in his fourth season. He can still really develop that in the next couple of years. So I think we've seen a lot of positive signs from Tyrese Maxey this year that really indicates that this breakout is here to stay. We've seen it over a whole season. We've seen it with some players, without some players, with him being the focal point of scouting reports. So Maxey is really going to be a mainstay, probably in my top 20 dynasty rankings for the next couple seasons. The second player we'll discuss on the upswing is Keon Ellis of the Sacramento Kings. And we're going a little deeper in the dynasty pool right now, but I really love what I've been seeing from Keon Ellis. He's been, I think, a pretty hot topic of debate, not debate, rather, a hot topic of late for his play on the Kings, especially when Kevin Huerter went down. So this may not be someone new that we're talking about. You probably have seen his name float out there. I personally noticed Keon Ellis back in the fall when I was there live for a Rockets vs. Kings game on November 6th. Keon Ellis filled in nicely, and I kind of did a double take. I hadn't really paid the closest attention to him before, and I was like, this guy should get a chance. He is providing solid defense, doing a good job pressuring Jalen Green, Fred VanVleet, sticking to them, gumming up some of the offensive works, and he's hitting some shots on the offensive end, which, hey, that's better than what Davion Mitchell normally provides. I thought at that time, back on November 6th, Keon Ellis should get a role. And we've seen him slowly earn more minutes in the rotation as the year's gone on. Not the year's gone on, as the season has gone on. And of course, that's been aided by Kevin Huerter's torn labrum injury. But I want to be clear on this. Keon Ellis has earned his minutes. I think he has deserved the minutes he is getting. In his last 12 games, 7 games started, 25 minutes per game, 45% from deep, granted on low volume, so let's caveat that there, that's on 3.3 attempts per game, but also averaging 1.6 steals and 0.8 blocks per game. A pretty impressive thing, pretty impressive stats from what you want to see from him. We'll get into the lack of lack of on-ball game later, but let's touch on those defensive stats again. So 1.6 steals per game, 0.8 blocks per game, that's yielded about a, over the entire season, he's had a 2.5% steal rate, 3.1% block rate. Those are both great indicators from a stats perspective on the defensive playmaking he can bring and the havoc creation he is providing for the Sacramento Kings, who do need a player like that in their lineup. They are lacking some of that defensive event creation. And watching the film, he is making a very clear impact. He's been good navigating screens. He is an event creator, as we just discussed. Event creation, I think, is really valuable for defensive players. And he has enough size to hold up against most guards in the league. So then what gives him staying power in the rotation over a player like Davion Mitchell, who is also billed as this defensive stopper? The difference is that Keon Ellis has just enough offense. As we discussed previously, the shot volume, it's not great, but it's respectable enough. He's taking about 5.8 threes per 36 minutes, which is a level at where you get guarded. It's not where he's a non-shooter, he won't take that open shot, and I'm not going to call him a great movement shooter or anything, but he's at least shown a willingness to take the open shot when it's presented itself, which is a decent amount of times on the Kings and the amount of shot creators they have on that team. And he's hitting them this year at a 39% rate. That's good. 39% on 5.8 per 36 minutes. Sign me up for that. That is good enough to survive on offense. Is it on a difficult shot diet? No, it's not at all. It's mainly open shots. He's not taking these movement contested shots. But hey, he's hitting them well, and that is better than not hitting them well. Sounds obvious, but I'd like that player on my team. He's not really doing too much else on the ball. He's not really a playmaker. He's not getting to the rim. He's not generating rim looks. He's not doing anything like that. And that's why he's in the deeper end of the dynasty range, right? But with all this being said, he has a very clear role on the defensive end and an area of need for the Kings while not taking anything away on the offensive table, which is a great compliment to the players they have on the team. And because he has signed for 2 more years, at a minimum contract. Great signing by the Kings, by the way. I expect him to be a mainstay in the rotation because he's just a nice, cheap rotation player they can have in place. I expect the Kings to explore Davion Mitchell trades in the upcoming offseason. He has 1 year and $6.5 million left on his contract, and that, paired with some other contracts, could make for a pretty sizable upgrade in the rotation. I'll expect the Kings to rely on the cheaper and, I'd say, better Keon Ellis to absorb those point of attack guard minutes as someone who also just fits in better with the team. So Keon Ellis, I think at this point, it's probably a little late to get in on him if he's probably already been scooped up in your dynasty league, depending on the size. But if you were in about, you know, let's just say a 20-team league with about 12 to 15 players rostered, I think you could take a look at him, add him to your squad, and hope he can provide some back-end fill-in moments for your squad as a depth option. Now, we'll get into some players on the downswing. And one big storyline and one big name, and who fits this category pretty well, is Mikal Bridges on the Brooklyn Nets. He has been not what we expected, no questions asked about it. He is one of those players where those small season samples that we discussed earlier can deceive you. It was about this point last March, or really post-trade deadline last year, he was traded from the Suns to the Nets in that KD blockbuster trade, and he really popped off on the Nets, and some even asked, why did the Suns trade for KD when they had KD at home and Mikal Bridges? Well, I even wrote a piece over the summer arguing that Mikal Bridges was showing was real due to not outlier levels of hitting a shot and field goal percentage per zone, and the Nets were playing real games. They were trying to get in the playoffs. Obviously, in hindsight, it's not been the case. That small season sample was not the real Mikal Bridges. But I think it's been a little overstated how bad he's been in terms of his scoring output and his role. Yes, his percentages are just straight up down across the board. I'm not going to argue that. But factoring in the shot diet and the volume compared to his previous role in Phoenix, it's actually pretty comparable across the board and per zone. It's just the volume of where he's taking his shots and how much is what's dragging down those percentages some. So what that means to me is, just while it's not the highs of last season, I don't think it's as disastrous as it feels. It is bad for fantasy, to be clear, though. Lower field goal percentage, that's never a good thing. We don't like seeing that, especially when it comes at the cost of higher volume. That's not a great pairing normally. What is also really bad for Mikal Bridges is the tailing off of his offensive stats. They're just straight up lower across the board. Less steals, less blocks, the steal rate and the block rate have declined. And he's just not making as much of an impact in the defensive department. Additionally, we haven't seen huge strides in the playmaking department either. We've seen some modest ones. There's a little bit of increase in the assist percentage. There's a little bit of an increase in the assist per game. But they're not really that big. He's turning the ball over a little more than he was last season as well. And yeah, there's just less faith that Mikal Bridges can really be this on-ball option for a good team, to be clear. Now, granted, yes, the Nets team context is quite poor, and that's something we have to consider, as we mentioned earlier on the pod. But that doesn't alleviate fantasy concerns around Mikal Bridges. It's pretty clear to me at this point that Bridges is not cut out to be a primary option role on a good team, and he would be much better served as a secondary offensive role. But who knows when that's going to happen for the Nets? These Nets have these grand dreams, it seems like, of using their draft picks from other teams to try to trade for a star. And I don't really believe in that plan. I think that's a little folly. They apparently turned down Jalen Green and some of their own draft picks for Mikal Bridges at this trade deadline, which doesn't really, I think that seems a bit ludicrous to not entertain that offer. But hey, here we are. I just don't see when Mikal Bridges will be in that secondary offensive role that we think that he could thrive in better for fantasy. Because of that, you're banking on the Nets just finding that realization. I don't think it's coming anytime soon. Maybe there's a buy low window, if you think Mikal Bridges will be in a favorable situation soon. I just don't see where that's coming from, though. The next player we'll discuss on the downswing is Spencer Dinwiddie of the Lakers. And he's been a bit of a meh point guard option for a while. He put up poor efficiency, but he's normally provided enough passing and playmaking and defense to be acceptable on an average NBA team. And the issue is now is that he's taken a buyout and he's on a minimum, and you might argue he's on an average NBA team in the Lakers, but it is a crowded backcourt on the Lakers, and that means a couple of things for him. First, obviously, he's just seeing less minutes, and that leads to less production. Minutes is normally king when it comes to fantasy, and he just does not have the same opportunity that he had at other locations. What that also means is that just less counting stats, right? Less points, less assists, less threes. Not good. The second is that he's seeing less of a role on the team. The Lakers have a lot of ball handling options from LeBron James, Austin Reeves, D'Angelo Russell, and his usage for Spencer Dinwiddie is down from 18% to 12%. That is a massive drop off, and we've seen his assists plummet as well. Considering assists was one of Spencer Dinwiddie's main allures as a fantasy player, that is pretty damaging to see. The third issue with Spencer Dinwiddie is once players start taking buyouts and minimums, they normally stay around that minimum contract level and they kind of contender hop slash sign sweetheart deals to chase that ring. We've seen that with Nicolas Batum and Russell Westbrook recently, where they took these buyouts and we kind of saw their roles decrease. And isn't that to say they became bad fantasy options, but they definitely became worse fantasy options. So because of that contract situation, it doesn't inspire any hope of Spencer Dinwiddie seeing a starting role or his role increasing forward in the future. There's a chance he may find himself in a less crowded ball handling situation than the Lakers. There are plenty of teams that could just use someone for some minutes to handle the ball. I mean, maybe the Magic, they could use a little bit additional ball handling and creation. Just spitballing some names out there. But I don't think the minutes would ever be there again that we've seen that he's had on the Mavericks, that he's had on the Nets. And not to mention, he's just an older player who looks, I think, materially worse at those things that made his fantasy game appealing. So this is an example where you have that team context come into play. And if you are a dynasty roster of Spencer Dinwiddie, I think it's very unlikely we see him provide what we would want him to provide in terms of those assists for fantasy.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Lastly, we'll discuss some teams to watch that I'll be keeping my eye on in the next week. The first of those teams is the Oklahoma City Thunder, who are fighting for a playoff spot, not for a playoff spot, for one of the top seeds in the Western Conference. And there's a lot of fascinating players for them. The first, obviously, is Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. Is he starting to wear down some? I think the playoffs will be telling, but we've already seen him rest on a back-to-back this past week. And the team even mentioned that, yeah, he's been dealing with a little bit of nagging injuries. He just needs to take a game off. So will we see some limited minutes for him going forward or even some less games? I don't think this is necessarily a huge issue for fantasy given how many players are doing this nowadays in the league. But it's a little concerning, and it's something to keep an eye on. It's something I'll be seeing if he looks like he's taking more of a physical toll with this massive offensive usage he has. The next two players I'll be honing on are Chet Holmgren and Jalen Williams. Are these players really the next two stars on this team to form this three-headed monster? I spoke about Jalen Williams a month ago, how I think he is that second offensive star for the Oklahoma City Thunder, and he's been putting up some major, massive lines recently. Is that going to be the case? On these games, or rather, if Shai Gilgeous-Alexander does miss some games, will we see Jalen Williams be able to step up and fulfill that primary offensive role well, or will he struggle a little bit as teams hone in on him? Chet Holmgren is one of those unicorns at center who can provide good rim protection, good switch ability, really be a defensive just skeleton key for a variety of schemes, while also providing some intriguing offensive ball skills. So how does he play off that? Can we see that usage up a little bit? Maybe not this season, but for future seasons, potentially. I want to see how he looks, and I really want to hone in on him. Another player I'm actually a little curious by is Lu Dort and his consistency. Over the year, he's taking less shots, but that's because he's basically cutting out the more difficult self-created shots out of his shot diet, and so he has a more manageable field goal percentage. How does he look if Shai has to miss some games or just in general on the team? They really seem to trust him with key defensive matchups, and so I'm going to be honing in on that and seeing how he looks in these different lineup configurations and the role he plays on a night-in and night-out basis. Josh Giddey is another interesting player. We spoke about him a couple weeks ago. Is his time up? He's actually been playing better of late. Even though Gordon Hayward's in town, who's kind of been a bit of a flop there. But does that mean Josh Giddey is going to see a role in the closing lineups? He did see that this past week against the Pelicans. And I'm kind of curious. Maybe he's starting to figure some things out a little bit. And the last player I'll be keeping an eye on for the Oklahoma City Thunder is Kayson Wallace. Really thought pre-draft that he could be fill a role right away as a defensive monster and defensive impact player. And I think we've seen shades of that. That has given him a role in the OKC rotation early on in his career. But does he have more to this game? His usage rate has been low, so it's another thing I'm going to be honing in on. The next team I'm going to be honing in on and watching is the New Orleans Pelicans. Zion has been really frisky and really awesome and electric the past month. I don't really love the term played himself into shape that's been used sometimes with Luka Doncic or James Harden, but it seems to be kind of apt here. Zion has really looked just noticeably quicker and noticeably more agile, and he's just been a delight to watch. I'm interested to see how his role continues to develop on this team and where he continues to go. Some of it has come with Brandon Ingram out, which is also something I'll be looking for. When/if Brandon Ingram comes back, how does that dynamic play out? That has always seemed to be a point of contention for the Pelicans. I'll also be looking at Trey Murphy III, who was dealing from his return from injury with meniscus in the first half of the year and looked very shaky. A lot of people seem to be getting out on him a little bit, but he's turned it on of late, and he's just someone I love watching. He's such a long, lengthy wing that can really do a lot of things well for the team, and I'm excited to see how he looks in the rotation. On the wing as well, you got to look at Herb Jones, who's having a fantastic defensive season, really just locking down players night in and night out. He's showing a little more on the offensive end, and I'm interested to see how that looks basically on a game-to-game basis. His offensive consistency has been a little questionable this year and is part of some of the ups and downs and the fluctuations we see from him. So I want to see if that's a product of how he's playing or his tendencies or anything like that. We've also seen some more limited minutes for Jonas Valanciunas. So is his time up? He's yielding some minutes to Larry Nance as the Pelicans trend to these small ball lineups, really, and like pairing Zion with Nance, as Nance provides a little bit more spacing than Jonas Valanciunas does. I don't think Jonas Valanciunas is necessarily a bad center. He's definitely not a good defensive center. But he does a lot of things well at the center spot. And I'm very curious to see if it's more just a Zion issue and Ingram's out, or if it's Jonas Valanciunas is really showing that age. And lastly, the Pelicans just have a bevy of rotation-level players. And they seem to have found the rotation they like, but Jose Alvarado, Jordan Hawkins, Najee Marshall, all names that I really am intrigued by and really appreciate their game. And I'm interested to see how this rotation looks and how they're distributing their minutes. Hawkins has kind of fallen out of the rotation as the team has gotten healthy and really just kind of playing spot minutes here and there. But I want to see if he's really just not looking as dynamic as a movement shooter or if it's something else. Jose Alvarado's always been the spark plug, small point guard option. I'm interested to see how he looks next to Zion and the rest of the team. And Najee Marshall, who is somewhat kind of like the wing version of Keon Ellis. He provides, not as good defensively, but he provides just enough on the offensive end and just enough on the defensive end to be one of those options you like filling out your rotation. So how much is he actually giving on the offensive end? That's something I'm interested in looking at. That will do it for this edition of the Pun Intended podcast. Not much more to add. I know last week I mentioned we're working on those Dynasty Recap series. We should be getting those out here in the next week, most likely. So be on the lookout for that at sportsethos.com. Other than that, see you all next week.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts, so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, Click Grainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.